I want to read to you an incident from a book which I think gives a feel of Uzbekistan. A few days later, first thing in the working day, Sakina from Freedom House sent another victim round to see me. His name was Mr. Atayev, and he was a small farmer from the town of Kitab, south of Kashi. His story was that he and three of his brothers had leased land from a state farm, or kolkhoz, there. The kolkhoz now wanted it back. The brothers had refused. As a result, one of the brothers had been murdered, and the second jailed for 7 years. The third had gone into hiding in Tashkent and was with me now. In the past week, his mother, who was 84 years old, had been beaten up by a mob and their apple orchard destroyed. The local authorities knew he was in Tashkent seeking help. They had told the family that no foreign embassy could change what happened in Kitab. I decided we should prove them wrong. I yelled to Christina, "Go home and pack. We're off to Kitab. Tell Mansur to get ready." Christina immediately got up and walked to the door. She paused, turned back and said, "The farm workers probably won't speak Russian. Do you know if they speak Uzbek or Tajik down there?" "Tajik, I should think," I conjectured. "It's near Shakrizabt. Does Dmitri or Victoria speak Tajik?" "No, I don't think so. Shall I try to find an interpreter?" "No, there's no time. Let's take Nadira. She can speak Uzbek and Tajik, and every other language as far as I can tell." "Shall we pay her as an interpreter?" "You mean my company's not payment enough?" "Not for me, it isn't." "But you're not Nadira." "Thank God. You're difficult enough as a boss. As a boyfriend, you must be impossible." Christina gave me that smile and disappeared to get ready for the trip. 2 hours later, we set off for Kitab. It was a 5-hour drive to Kashi. Uzbekistan was in the grip of a diesel shortage, and after Samarkand, we had to head into a farm where, for a backhander, they siphoned diesel from a tractor for us. We arrived in Kashi after 3 p.m., checked into a hotel, and then sped on to Kitab, a further hour's drive. I had to quell a rebellion in Kashi from the rest of the party, as none of us had eaten all day, but I insisted we didn't have time to stop. I bought bread and cheese to eat in the car. We arrived after 5 p.m. Driving into the deepest countryside, we looked for our small farm. Eventually, we found it. There was no longer much to see. The cattle stalls were broken and abandoned, the fields overgrown with weeds. There were 3 cottages close together. One had belonged to the murdered brother, one to the imprisoned. The womenfolk now all lived together in the third. When we met them, they started pouring out their stories at us all at once, and it was difficult to grasp anything coherent. It turned out they spoke Uzbek rather than Tajik. One thing they did say was that kolkhoz had moved recently retired military personnel into the vacated cottages. They had been carrying out a campaign of violence and intimidation. This was rapidly borne out. As we stood talking in a field, 3 swarthy men came up to us carrying farm tools in a menacing manner. One stepped forward and prodded me twice on the neck, hectoring me. I didn't understand him, but it was plain he was telling me to go away. He poked me in the chest again, so I slapped him across the face, hard but with an open palm. Surprised, he backed off for a moment. Mansur was out of sight in the car, and I was alone in the field with Nadira, Christina, and the 3 Uzbek women. Suddenly, Nadira was in front of me, yelling angrily in a throaty language and seemingly threatening the 3 men who stood facing her with mattocks in hand, but looking uncertain whether to use them. I put a restraining hand on Nadira's shoulder and asked her what had happened. She was shaking with fury. He said they would beat you dead and rape your women. Christina, who had not previously understood the Uzbek exchange, started to look very nervous and go back down the path. I thought that was psychologically dangerous, so I stepped forward and pushed what seemed to be the leader in the chest, saying loudly that I was the British ambassador. I had no hope he would understand me, but thought that the unknown tongue might give him pause. My heart was in my mouth, and it was not help when one of the Atayev women said something which Nadira translated. She says, "These are the men who murdered her husband." Although they looked like they would murder their mothers for a plate of beans, fortunately, they were not quite certain if they were meant to murder me. I decided to shout a bit more, and they shrugged their shoulders, turned their backs, and walked across to the far side of the field. There they sat on the fence and looked at us, occasionally hefting their mattocks menacingly from hand to hand. As we talked on with the women, we were joined by 2 male cousins of Itayev family and an earnest young Russian who had been sent to the village by a Samarkand human rights group. The story was as I had been told it in Tashkent. The family had leased land from the kolkhoz in the brief spring of liberalisation in the mid-1990s. For a while it had flourished with cattle and apples. Then the kolkhoz had decided they wanted it back, and what had followed was violence, intimidation, and theft or destruction of livestock and crops. The brother who had been jailed was convicted of stealing his own apples, as the court ruled they should be the property of a kolkhoz, which owned the land. The fact that the brother had paid for a lease was ignored by the court. The family had invited me to go into the village and meet the grandmother who had been beaten. It had been over 40 degrees Celsius that day. It was still very hot and the walk seemed long. We eventually reached the old lady's home. She was standing in her courtyard. She showed me her destroyed vegetable patch and then took me inside the little house with its plain walls of mud and dung. It was totally bare. Everything had been stripped out by her attackers. Then in the courtyard, she astonished me by pulling down her dress. Her shriveled breasts, arms and upper torso were covered in huge livid blue and purple bruises, some of which were still bleeding. She had been beaten mercilessly with clubs 3 days ago. She was 84 years old. She stood there defiant, half naked, having moved beyond shame. I was boiling with rage. We then walked round a corner, and my eyes were struck by an even more arresting sight. It was the entire family's orchard. A field stretched down the hill as far as the eye could see, and row upon row of felled apple trees, perhaps thousands of them, lay in terrible death, their black and gnarled limbs looking like a great litter of charred and twisted bodies. The leaves were coming away, and here and there great sweeps of late blossom were browning and giving off the sweet smell of decay. Over each stood, for a headstone, a golden-topped stump. That wanton destruction of so much goodness, that loss of so much potential, seemed a metaphor for all the cruelty and waste of Karimov's Uzbekistan. I went on at that village to ask who had cut down the trees, because cutting down thousands of apple trees is a time-consuming job. Because it was so unusual to have a foreigner in the village, a lot of the villagers had come out to look at me, and it turned out it was they. They had cut down the apple trees, even though they were the neighbours and very often the relatives of this poor family who were being attacked. When I asked why, I was told it was because the kolkhoz had paid 200 sum to every man who took part in cutting down the apple trees. Now, 200 sum is 20 US cents. And a society that's been so debased that for 20 cents people will ruin someone else's livelihood and be, you know, the accomplices to the beating, murder and imprisonment of an innocent family, is a society that's in deep trouble. And part of the reason it's in such deep trouble is the desperation of the people. On that kolkhoz, the salary which people got, the ordinary workers, and there were 16,000 workers on that state farm, and the salary they were getting was 2,000 sum a month. That's $2 a month for a lot of hard, backbreaking work in the cotton fields. And Uzbekistan's economy is founded on cotton. It's the second largest exporter of cotton in the world. And the people who work on the farms are effectively slaves. They can't leave. In Uzbekistan, if you want to move from one town to another town, you need police permission. You need a propusk, in a visa, effectively, internal visa in your passport, and you need permission from the police to register your new address. And if you're a cotton worker, you'll never get it. You are tied to the land as surely as any serf or slave. And that is the majority of the population. Children as young as 8 years old are pressed into the cotton fields to pick cotton. All students, the autumn term doesn't exist. Students and staff are sent into the cotton fields. Children as young as 8 years old are working 12 hours a day in those cotton fields. Now, that's just one aspect of Uzbekistan. I'd been British ambassador in Uzbekistan for a fortnight when I heard a dissident trial was happening, trial of a gentleman called Huda Begainov.
Iskander Hudibeganov and five others. And I went to that trial to get a feel for what was going on in the country. And an incident happened which really set me on the path that led me here.
There's one thing that really was the determining factor. It was this. It was an old man giving evidence. He had sworn a statement that two of the accused, who were his nephews, were members of Al-Qaeda and had travelled to Afghanistan and had met with Osama bin Laden in person. He was a very aged gentleman. He was wearing traditional Uzbek costume, long quilted gown, black lacquered hat. He had a long white beard.
And giving his evidence, he was obviously terrified, very, very much intimidated. And he suddenly, from somewhere, found an inner strength, and he stood taller.
And he said, "This is not true. They tortured my children in front of me until I signed this. We are good Muslims, but we are poor farmers from Andijan. What do we know about Osama bin Laden?"
And I confess this is not entirely rational, but my strong instinct, my intuition, being so close to him, was that what he was saying then was indeed the truth. It rang true.
And he must have realised that at that moment he was very likely signing his own death warrant. It was very powerful, and it led me to start questioning so much that I was hearing. I was under an instruction as British ambassador that I was never to speak in public in Uzbekistan without starting off by acknowledging our thanks for the help Uzbekistan was given in war on terror and for being a member of the coalition of the willing.
The news I was interested in human rights started to get other people to come in and see me. People started coming to me with their problems. And very, very shortly after that dissident trial, photos arrived on my desk, and they were of a body. And it wasn't plain to me what had happened to this body. From the condition of the body, you couldn't really understand what had happened. So I sent them off to the University of Glasgow Pathology Department for a report. Now, the gentleman had come from the Jaslik Gulag, which has at least 7,000 political prisoners. I actually would put a much higher figure on it. His corpse had been returned to his mother in a sealed casket. She had been ordered to bury it the next day without opening the casket. She had certain religious duties to perform by way of washing the body. So she got the casket out onto the table, and when she saw its condition, she took these photos, which came to me. And the report came back from Glasgow University, and he said that his fingernails had been pulled out, he'd been beaten about the face and the neck, and he died of immersion in boiling liquid. More people came to me. We began to build up this picture of torture happening in Uzbekistan on what I can only call an industrial scale, thousands of people a year being tortured. And the torture had two purposes, basically. First purpose was simply to terrorise and intimidate the population. If you want to keep a population working effectively in conditions of serfdom, you have to intimidate them. The second purpose was to provide intelligence. And the intelligence material,
as we got the information on people being tortured, we started to get information as to what people were forced to confess to. And they were regularly being forced to confess to being members of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan.
And often they were forced to confess to travelling to Afghanistan and meeting with Osama bin Laden in person. That came up repeatedly. In fact, Osama bin Laden seemed to have nothing better to do than meet Uzbeks. At the same time as British ambassador, I was seeing the intelligence material from the CIA. And the CIA material said exactly the same stuff that we knew people were being forced to sign up to in the torture chambers, naming people as members of the IMU and of Al-Qaeda. People who I knew, people who were often the democratic opposition, people who were dissident. And it said they travelled to Afghanistan and met Osama bin Laden. And what's more, it said on the face of it, it said in the briefing that this came from debriefing. That was the euphemism, debriefing of detainees by the Uzbek Security Service. It became plain to me what that meant. I asked my deputy to go over to the American embassy and say I was worried this was coming from torture. And she came back saying that their reply, which came, I think, from their political counsellor, was that, yes, it probably did come from torture, but in the context of the war on terror, they didn't see that as a problem. I did see it as a problem.
You've got the immorality, you've got the illegality, and then the fact the information was nonsense anyway. People ask me how I knew it was nonsense.
The very strong example was that there was CIA intelligence from a detainee about a training camp in the hills of Tajikistan above Samarkand, where the Al-Qaeda were training people to swoop down on the city of Samarkand. And then my defence attaché, Colonel Ridout, had actually been to that place and there was nothing there. It was untrue.
I protested back to London that we were obtaining intelligence got by torture and that it was wrong. I recall one of the first responses was a letter from a foreign office, which I'll never forget, wonderful phrase. It said, Foreign Commonwealth Office was becoming concerned that I was perhaps over-focused on human rights.
I then was called back to a meeting which took place on either the 7th or the 8th of March 2003. And at that meeting, I was told three things. Sir Michael Wood, the Foreign Office's chief legal advisor, told me that it was not illegal for us to obtain intelligence under torture, provided A, that we didn't do the torturing ourselves, or B, that we did not specifically request that a named individual be tortured. As long as we did neither of those, we weren't breaking the law, he said, in obtaining intelligence under torture. The second thing I was told was that Jack Straw had met with Sir Richard Dearlove, then head of MI6, and they had decided, as a matter of policy, that in the war on terror, we would use intelligence obtained under torture. And I was told, that's a policy, you're a civil servant, shut up. But the third thing I was told is actually what worries me most of all, in a sense.
I kept saying, but the intelligence is untrue. Why do we want this untrue intelligence? You know, it's untrue. Every time I said it was untrue, a gentleman representing MI6, he would reply, he wouldn't say it is true, but he would say it is operationally useful. I'd say untrue, he'd say operationally useful. But intelligence is nowadays judged, not is it true or not, but by operational utility.
The Foreign Office legal advisor, who was giving us legal advice, working out how to legally get down the prohibition on torture, Sir Michael Wood, is genuinely one of the nicest people I know. And when I walked into that room, thinking I'm in trouble, I'm going to get sacked, possibly, certainly carpeted for my opposition to torture, and I saw Michael sitting there, I thought, he's a good guy, he'll be against torture, I have an ally.
And when he started coming out with this, oh, well, as long as we don't actually do the torturing ourselves or specifically request and named it, I was stunned.
At that moment, I think I understood how in Germany, a civil servant who is a nice guy and kind to his kids could be ordering cattle trucks to go to Auschwitz and thinking, I'm only doing my job. And once we start to give up on human rights, that's the direction we go in. And that's the last thought I want to leave it with today. Thank you.